Welcome to the session using collective impact strategies to support a bridge between public health and health care. I have the privilege of serving as the CEO for the National Network of Public Health Institutes, and we're just delighted to have both Michael and Amy with us today for this session. Michael works with the Institute for Public Health Innovation. I was thinking this morning, Michael, I think we go back now over 20 years. We work together in a variety of settings. He is the president and CEO of the Institute for Public Health Innovation, which serves the District of Columbia, Maryland, and Virginia. And he has worked for over 20 years on local, regional, and national levels to improve the public's health, with a particular focus on strengthening local health systems and reducing health inequities through innovative community strategies. Amy Stevens, and Amy, one of your colleagues at your institute, is nice to work with you today, leads the work in Ohio at the Ohio Public Health Institute. Prior to that, she served as an evaluation coordinator. She does a lot of work on public health and prevention, health policy in Ohio. And she was program evaluation consultant in her previous life with in public health and behavioral health organizations in rural Ohio. And she has also worked as a project coordinator at the Institute for Policy Research at Northwestern University. And she holds master's degrees in public health and social work from the University of Minnesota. So we're in for a treat with these folks. In addition to the CEU sort of language that you see for anyone claiming continuing education, we also have some other goals that I hope we will accomplish today. So we really do want to look at some of the early seeds that we're going to hear from that are being planted both in the Mid-Atlantic and Ohio around this collective impact work. How many of you are engaged right now in collective impact work? Sort of, okay. So how many of you are planning to be engaged in collective impact? Okay, yeah. Fair enough, so it's going to be taking more shape. We also want to talk about some of the roles that, you know, institutes play. Are any of you at a public health institute? University? Health department? Okay, there you go. Healthcare setting? Awesome, okay. And we do want to leave some time to hear what you think, explore your ideas, questions, and so we will do that. And I have a little clock here that will just keep us on time, and so so we do leave some time for hearing from you all. I don't have any relationships to disclose, and as far as I know, my two colleagues here do not either. So we are meeting the APHA guidelines. Just real quickly, a little bit about the National Network of Public Health Institutes. We are a network of institutes across the country. We're now up to 43 public health institutes in 31 states. We actually serve all the 10 HHS regions, and there's activity, public health activity going on in all 50 states. We have just recently added the 10 regional public health training centers. And they have 39 local performance sites, so that's all part of the network now. And so this is a really great session for me personally, because we're trying to think about how are we thinking about the network in terms of collective impact for capacity building. And so we are also doing some work to expand the services that institutes offer, and maybe creating institutes that will serve Indian Country, because there's obviously a great need. So we have New Orleans office and we have a DC office, so we welcome you to New Orleans, and hopefully the weather will warm up a little bit. I won't go through too much detail, but we're really a network of fostering innovation and population health improvement. And so what you hear today from both Ohio and from the D.C. Mid-Atlantic area is about the type of innovative work that are going on in the institutes. And obviously the multi-sector frame is so important if we're going to really achieve the health and all policies vision and get beyond sort of the disease-based, you know, work that we're doing, but creating health in our societies and our communities. So institutes, we're doing a lot of work to try to get more institutes in that particular sort of northwestern region and the southwest as well. So hopefully the next time we all see you at APHA, that map is filled in a little bit more. But we do have the capacity to reach lots of areas in all 50 states as well. Sorry for this slide. These are just some of the, I have to fix the formatting on it. These are just some of the services and sort of functional areas of expertise that institutes are involved in. It's not an exhaustive list, but a lot of times people say, well, you know, what does a public health institute really do? So if you're at a health department and you have an institute in your area, or if you're in a healthcare setting or a university setting, it's good to get to know them and to, you know, to work on some projects together. And they may define their services a little different, but these are essentially the core of what they do. So I hope that this session, when we talk a little bit about collective impact, I hope that we move from the sort of chaotic images that we may have in our head to more of a clear sort of, this is what I could take home, and this is personally what I will try to take home, is sort of what can we do as a network to strategize. So with that, I'll invite Michael up. So the question was, how are institutes funded? So a variety of funding mechanisms, some state money within their states, a lot of federal dollars, private philanthropy, and then services, direct services. So it's a big mixture. And I invite you two to share when you during your presentation anything about your funding picture.
Morning, everyone. I invite you, if you're comfortable, to come up a little bit closer. Everybody's kind of spread out. I'm looking forward to sharing with you an example of, and in all honesty, I don't know that we were completely thinking collective impact when we started the work I'm going to describe for you, but it evolved into something that we understood to be collective impact. And there's some interesting dimensions. One is going to be around, you know, how do you move from a, or what's the difference between a more traditional, in this case, chronic and infectious disease-focused behavioral intervention and a more collective impact approach that includes structural goals, structural change goals, systems change goals. We're also going to talk about how public health workforce is an important area of focus for systems change. And we're going to talk about how in our intervention we quickly move to focusing on that. It's actually become a dominant area of work for us that developed out of what was really mostly a behavioral intervention at first. So, because we're a small enough group, I don't know if anyone wants to share like what compelled you to come to this session, because maybe we can emphasize some of the things that you're interested in. Does anyone have something at the top of their heads that there's so many different choices?
We're down the road.
Great. You're Stephen, right?
Yes.
It's good to see you. Michael Ryan. Yeah, we haven't met in person, but we've talked, so I'm glad you're here. Anyone else? Yes.
I'm from Marin County, California, and I work for a community foundation that's going to be piloting some work in integrating upstream approaches in primary care. And we've been wondering who's going to be doing it and how do we build the infrastructure to support that longer term. And hadn't thought about the Public Health Institute as a potential partner. So
great. Uh-huh. Yes, ma'am.
Kirsten from Washington State. We are going to be, we're in Pierce County, Tacoma, Pierce County, one of the regional leads for developing accountable communities of health. We're in the process of developing our governance model for delivery of services for ACH, and we're really struggling to come up with strategies and figure out how to really have the community and health sector side come together under a governance model for delivering a service for the
Great. Well, it's a nice array. There's so many different angles that you can come at this. So luckily, we just have two presenters on our panel, so and lots of you with experience and questions. So we're going to save time so we can kind of work through this together, and maybe we can touch on some things that weren't necessarily in the presentations. So I'm going to talk about a specific case example, and it's just a place to start a conversation, really, because there's a lot of different ways you can come through this. But it's one of our collective impact efforts, and it just is an interesting example because it shows how you can move to more systems level change approaches, pull in different partners, use the backbone structure, all work towards common goals. And it has this interesting workforce dimension that we'll talk about. And within that, we might talk a little bit more specifically beyond just the collective impact approach to workforce development. What are those community-based workforce development opportunities that we're seeing that could benefit from collective approaches? And we'll just share some of our lessons learned. So Vinny talked about the role of public health institutes and communities, and that's very much the role that we play, serving the District of Columbia, the Commonwealth of Virginia, and the state of Maryland. And really our focus is on building those collective approaches, those partnership-based, multi-sectoral efforts that really focus on evidence-based public health as well as innovative activity with a focus on health equity. So I think many of us have moved beyond these more what I, for lack of a better term, I call a traditional public health approach, but I think we all are still part of them. They tend to have a few partners. The reason that we pursued a particular opportunity is because of organizational interests or perceived needs. We didn't have the time or didn't take the time to do a real formative research process. The lead agency tends to often be doing the work. It may be single-level intervention. In other words, might be focused on policy change or behavioral change or community change, but rarely like all those components in one. And typically in public health, there's a lot of effort focused on behavioral change. I think as a field, we've moved beyond that in the last decade or so. And so as a result of all that, there's generally one organization or just a couple that are accountable for the results. So a collective approach, and this doesn't put everything in the precise boxes of the collective impact as it was described by Stanford in 2011, but it's basically the idea is that you move to bring in a lot of partners to focus on a common goal. We believe that it's really important to engage in a process that a formative process that really understands what the community level need is. So that design that kind of drives what the collaborative is focused on together. The lead agency tends to be more of a backbone and not as much of a service provider. It's a multi-level intervention, and it may be so because you're trying to get at the different dimensions of change, or it may be because each of the different partners have different pieces of the effort, but they're all focused towards common goals. And then there's that structural change element or that systems change element, as well as shared accountability and measurement. So these are, I find it helpful to kind of think about the differences between what we often see in public health versus what might be a collective approach. And this is the approach that we took from the outset, but we weren't, again, calling it collective impact at first, to address HIV/AIDS issues in the District of Columbia. And this is just one example, and we're actually involved in a couple of collective impact efforts, but this is the one that has been going on for a while, and I think it's an interesting example. So in D.C., the reason that we needed a scaled, broad-based, partnership-based approach is because the HIV epidemic has been out of control in the District of Columbia for a while. Just to put it in perspective, 3 to 5% of the entire population is positive in the district. A generalized epidemic at a global level is considered to be 1%. And within certain population subgroups where there is high poverty, we see even higher rates. So women and neighborhoods, poor neighborhoods in D.C. are as much as 6% seropositive. We also found when we started this work that nearly half of people living with HIV in D.C. had not been in care, even though most of them were aware of their diagnosis. And the research was telling us that really treatment is the most effective means of preventing further transmission and moving towards eliminating the epidemic, because when you reduce viral load, you reduce the likelihood of transmission. So we knew as a community that we all had to come together somehow to address this issue. So we, private funders in the health department, came to us as a public health institute, I think recognizing that backbone role we could play to do some formative research to really understand what is going on. And we took a fresh look at the data. We did community viral load analysis, which is really interesting, and I'll explain in a minute. We did a whole bunch of interviews. We looked at the policy landscape. Keep in mind that the ACA had just passed, so we were in this new policy context. So and what we learned from this formative phase, and we were responding to a grant opportunity. I know all of us feel like the pressure, you can't really do this formative research. But we did this in about a month and a half, and we were leading the grant proposal writing process. And trust me, as it got like 2 weeks away from the deadline, I was thinking, can we really do more interviews? But the proposal came together so quickly and so thoroughly and in a very focused way because we were processing and thinking and working with the community. So I think it is worth taking that time. So the data that came out of the formative research showed us a few things. It showed us where to focus our intervention, on what populations, but it also showed us that there was this workforce element and this structural opportunity that we saw, and that's how we evolved into not just a behavioral intervention, but a systems change intervention. That was really around in the HIV field. There has been a history of using peers for outreach and navigation of the system, but they have often been more volunteer-based, lightly trained, episodic, one organization at a time, not sustainable, no systems-level structures to support this peer-based workforce. And the ACA coming out and sort of really talking about the role of community health workers, and we all know what's happened in the last 3 years around the movement around community health workers. Well, this was at the very outset of that, and we sort of saw there's this opportunity to build a community-based workforce while we're pursuing these health outcomes goals. I want to show you the community viral load analysis because it's pretty cool. So instead, traditionally, prior to 2010, when we put together this project, all over the country, the way that you looked at the HIV epidemic was really to look at where people living with HIV were, and to look at risk groups and to sort of focus on risk and where the people are. But community viral load analysis, which was first introduced in San Francisco, and I think D.C. was the second jurisdiction to take it up, looked at the viral load of populations because that was an indicator of whether people were in care or not, and also the amount of virus in particular communities contributed to risk. So this shows, if you know anything about D.C., the right-hand side of D.C. is Eastern D.C., and it's as you move east in D.C., there tends to be greater poverty. So we see that, I don't show you the other maps, but this is the one that shows the geography, and what we know is wards 5 through 8, the dark ones on the right, have the highest poverty, the lowest education rates, and the highest unemployment. So we were seeing a correlation between community viral load and those indicators. So we ended up focusing on those communities and the risk and the populations, particularly African American women and heterosexual men in those communities, which tended to be the folks that you didn't traditionally focus on as much in HIV work. They were the communities they were the populations that had the highest community viral load in these neighborhoods. So looking at the data in a different way was really useful. This is how we started to think about our targeted outcomes. So we were going to engage people and retain them in HIV care, reduce their individual viral load, and improve their individual health and quality of life. We were also going to reduce community viral load as a community outcome. And then our health systems change goals were new HIV care models. We were going to change the way that services were delivered in the city, and we were going to strengthen and expand the community health workforce. So what we ended up doing is developing a linkage and retention in HIV care model for primarily for African American women, but not exclusively, in particular neighborhoods. And we were going to employ 12 community health workers, mostly full-time, across 8 community-based and medical providers across the city, across those wards that I showed. And for the structural change focus, we were going to, again, look at the service system and at the community and organizational levels, but specifically around the workforce, we were going to develop a training system for the community, for community health workers. We were going to collaboratively work with the community to formalize the community health workforce, and we were going to create a professional association in the city. And then finally, we committed ourselves to working on finance reform, which became much clearer in the last year about what that really would be. In the beginning, we didn't really know, and we'll talk a little bit about it later. So these are some of our Community Health Workers for Positive Pathways. That's the name of this program, and kind of gives you a little bit of feel of the human side of what we're doing. So this is the collective impact structure. So you see, we have IPHI, Institute for Public Health Innovation, as the backbone that's kind of coordinating everything. And you know, we kind of move away from thinking about it as our initiative. We don't really use that language. We're sort of the coordinator. And we have important partnerships with the health department, training partners. We're facilitating workforce development work in collaboration with others. But most important, we have these medical partners, these community-based partners, and a Medicaid managed care organization where we place our community health workers. Sometimes they're employed by us and placed in the organizations, and sometimes the organizations hire them. But we're all kind of working together, sharing strategies, supporting each other. We convene monthly, all the supervisors of the community health workers and the managing staff at each of these entities. All work together on data collection and evaluation and holding. And so there's a real sense of shared accountability. And all these organizations were involved in the formative research, so it was really I've been actually kind of amazed how together everyone is, because I think we've all participated in collaborative work where folks just kind of, you know, drag into the meetings and they feel like, do we really need to meet again? We all know what we're doing. But everybody's really been super engaged, and there are other collaborative projects in the city where we don't see folks as engaged, and I think it has to do with we all created something together, and we all really believe in the what we're trying to change, and we all have a role and can see how we affect the shared goals that we're working towards. So all the entities involved have been collecting the medical care re-engagement Steve, I saw you look back. Is it noisy back there? Do we need to close the door, you think? So all the entities are gathering information, and our community health workers have handheld devices, and it's all kind of uploading. And then we, with the medical partners, the community health workers have access to the medical record systems. So we're getting both service data, but also health outcome data. So we have CD4 counts and viral loads on all the clients in the program. So it's just this really effective shared data system that we're all working together. That's quite simple, but it works. And then for the structural change outcomes are a little bit more straightforward, and we don't really need a system for that. I want to talk about the workforce elements in particular. I think you all may know that CMS changed its rule last year that allows, and went into effect on January 1st, it allows states to amend their state Medicaid plans so that we no longer have to, it's no longer the case where medical or licensed clinical providers have to provide a preventive health service that's funded by Medicaid, financed by Medicaid. They can merely recommend it, and then a non-licensed professional can deliver that service. So it's one word change from provide to recommend or deliver to recommend, but it has pretty significant effects. So there's many state groups around the country that are working to help influence the development of a state plan amendment for Medicaid so that services that public health have often provided in the community by non-licensed professionals, so we're talking about community health workers, health coaches, lactation consultants, nutritionists, there's a whole range of folks that don't that may have some type of credentialing or not, but they don't technically have a license. So this has opened the door for community health workers in particular, but there's some work to do because we haven't defined what the community health workforce scope of practice is and sufficient with sufficient clarity that everyone will kind of understand what community health workers do vis-a-vis other types of professionals. And very few states have any type of credentialing system that kind of validates what the training and core competencies that community health workers need and certifies that the community health worker has those qualifications. So in the District of Columbia, Maryland, and Virginia, we were involved in processes in all three of these jurisdictions to move that work forward. In D.C. and Virginia, we had to convene the effort ourselves. In Maryland, there was legislation that was passed and that created a work group to work on this, so the health department is heading that up, but we're on the work group. So in D.C. specifically, where we're doing the positive pathways work, this obviously dovetails nicely with what we had envisioned around the workforce strategies, but the policy shift in the context of our project was going on opened up some great opportunities. So we created the Community Prevention and Medicaid Task Force, and underneath that we have a group that's focused on the financing mechanisms, a group that's focused on community health workforce development, and then we have the newly created Community Health Worker Professional Association feeding into that. And then another structure for this work is the training center that IPHI has developed over the course of this initiative, and you'll see in a few minutes how this has really ballooned in a significant scale across our region. So there's this new training capacity now for community health worker training that lies with us, but there are many other groups that do the trainings as well. So I mentioned the efforts to develop the scope of practice, really identify core competencies and outline what those are, the training requirements of community health workers, and make some recommendations on a credentialing system. So with the finance reform, what we'll need to do is really define the service and service providers that will be authorized to provide a certain type of preventive health service, and generally the states are going to require that this be a service that fits in the already approved services that funded by Medicaid. I think any expansion of coverage is going to not be viewed favorably. So what we're doing is a lot of the functions that a community health worker provides that we were implementing in positive pathways, like care coordination, system navigation, outreach and education, linkage and retention and care, treatment adherence support, those types of functions could fit in the current scope of services financed by Medicaid, but they may not be explicit, so we have to really work to help the Medicaid department see how this fits in the broad definitions of services that they already have in their plans. We'll need to determine cost and cost codes, eligible populations, and then the financing mechanism, like is this fee-for-service, is it through the Medicaid managed care organizations, are we going to experiment with some bundled payment models? And fortunately in our work group we have finance experts, Medicaid experts that are working on this, and then we have folks that are working on the workforce development aspects, and they're talking to each other. So we often organize the task force meetings so that the first half are the two work groups working separately, and then the second half of the meeting we're all coming together and sharing where we are and how our work reinforces each other. And I want to mention briefly as well that we can't just rely on the Medicaid financing because that's just going to be for certain services, community health workers. There will be many community health workers that won't want to participate in the Medicaid system, or many providers that aren't going to be able to bill Medicaid. So we're working with healthcare providers to really think about how the community health worker strategy is a good business strategy, and how they need to consider building that in to the cost of business. So real briefly, I'm almost finished here, but I just want to mention that we, since we started the work, we've had a huge scaling up and out. So we begun working with different healthcare providers like hospitals to pilot community health worker-based services as a business strategy. We've started doing what we do in D.C. and various parts of Maryland and Virginia, specifically focused on HIV, as well as branching out into other areas. We've regionalized our training work, and IPHI alone has trained over 250 community health workers in the last 4 years. We have community health worker associations in all three jurisdictions, or almost in Virginia, so in a couple weeks we'll have one in all three jurisdictions. We have community health worker policy bodies in all three jurisdictions. And then IPHI, with over 20 of our partners, created the Center for the Community Health Workforce, which gives us now a regional dimension of this backbone concept, specifically around the type of work that we've talked about here. So we have seen that the service delivery model is changing. Many of the providers are now integrating community health workers into their work in a sustainable way. The HIV policy environment has changed to incorporate community health workers using some of the precise language that we've used to describe our program. So the DC government now, with its $17 million Ryan White Part A program, has a whole tier specifically around regional community health worker services. And then the other two tiers, they require medical providers and support service organizations to describe how they will integrate community health workers into the model. None of that existed before our project. We've served over 1,200 people living with HIV, and we're finding some significant indication that the intervention is effective. Some of our data still needs to be cleaned up, but we are seeing the reductions in viral load, and then we're making progress towards the professionalization. So in wrapping up, I'll just say that everything that we described, and it's really ballooned out, and there were all these opportunities around systems change and workforce development, that we've managed to capitalize on the opportunities as a backbone, but it has really pushed us. And I think that the funders are going to need to think about investing in simply the backbone structure as well as just the interventions, because that backbone is obviously critical to all this work. And it has really pushed us to, I can't say that we necessarily had all the capacity we needed, but we had to do it, and so we got there. But I think the investment would be helpful. The formative research is really critical, and I just want to suggest to folks to really build in those structural goals to all of their work, so that we're taking advantage of opportunities for systems change while we're also looking for those health outcome changes. So I think I'll stop there, and maybe we'll have a chance for discussion.
Thank you. Appreciate that, Michael.